Hello, I'm Christian Gravener, and this is number 0294, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0294. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actor Charlie Kuntz, one of the stars of the new CBS series CSI Cyber. How does it feel to be part of such a hit franchise?
It feels awesome. After a few years of cutting my teeth on Community, it feels amazing to be able to go to work every day and be able to be part of CBS, which is huge, and CSI, which is huge, and just get to work with all these awesome actors, which, of course, is my favorite part. So, yeah, it's kind of mind-blowing in a lot of different ways.
David Healy, co-author of In the Company of Legends, which reminisces about working with some of Hollywood's biggest icons.
They are consummate with professionals, and one of the things that we did discover was that the stars that were raised in the studio system from the 30s and 40s and 50s have a tremendous discipline. You tell them when you want them to turn up, and they're there. In the case of Katharine Hepburn, she was always there early. I wonder why we weren't ready. So, yes, of course, they deserve respect, but of course, they're real people, too, and as time went on, we got to know some of them and discovered what was behind the facade of the famous person.
Former RCMP officer Simon Gervais, author of the thriller The Thin Black Line.
I've always been an avid reader. So when I worked counterterrorism, I was traveling a lot. So I had a lot of time to read books. Me and my colleagues suddenly realized that these books, okay, they have a good plot, but they aren't realistic. It's not how it is in the field. So I came with an idea. Maybe I should write something that's going to appeal to law enforcement officer and military personnel that actually serve in the field, and they will be able to relate to my book much better. So that's how I started.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0294, was Christian Gravener, a journalist and author of the book Montreal, the Unknown City. He's also the keeper of an excellent blog called Coolopolis. Check it out. As a matter of fact, you can go to the What's On page of this show, which Christian just told you about, 0294, and you'll find the link to Coolopolis. And thank you very much, Christian, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? According to the mayor of Rio de Janeiro, it appears that some of the 2016 Summer Olympics aquatic events will take place among floating household trash and raw sewage in Guanabara Bay, although the mayor, Eduardo Paes, noted to the Associated Press in March that the events are scheduled for the cleanest part of the bay. Oh, that's comforting. To acquire the games, organizers had promised a massive cleanup, but now, with 500 days to go, just 500 days to go, Paes conceded that the goals will not be met and that, indeed, infrastructure improvements still have not halted the sewage flow into the bay. First Sochi, now this. Have you noticed over the last little while that it seems the IOC acts like they're giving out the Olympic rights to slumlords? You get that feeling? Yeah. And according to the 17-year-old cyclist who was broadsided by a motorist at rush hour in Sheffield, England on March 6th, a woman at first alighted from the car to help. However, upon seeing the extent of the cyclist's injuries, she apologized and walked away, telling the sprawled-out victim that her children were in the car and would be scared to see all that blood, and so she would drive them on to school. Witnesses provided a description of the vehicle, but the hit-and-run driver was still at large at press time. Oh, I'm sure they'll find her. And when they do, her children will be scared to see Mommy going to jail. Yeah. Meanwhile, trying to stake out a position on the Paris murders of the staff of Charlie Hebdo magazine, Pope Francis in January told an audience during his Philippines tour that freedom of speech is important, but that there are limits. If my good dear friend Dr. Alberto Gasparri, who organized the Pope's visit and was standing right next to him, by the way, says a curse word against my mother, Francis said. He could expect a punch. He then threw a mock punch toward Gasparri. The Vatican press office was later moved to clarify that violence in God's name can never be justified. Yeah, but can you imagine being taken down by a pope? Wow, now there's a cage match I'd like to see. Meanwhile, a Michigan college student's April Fool's prank gone wrong was blamed for an apartment fire that led to a building being evacuated. The Allendale Fire Department responded on April Fool's morning to battle the blaze in an apartment near the campus of Grand Valley State University. Investigators said the fire apparently started when one of the four female college students living in the apartment tossed a firecracker at a roommate as part of an April Fool's prank, and the firework landed in a hamper, igniting the laundry inside. Neighbors said the girls knocked on the doors of other units in the search of a fire extinguisher, but the fire had grown too large by the time they were able to bring one back to the apartment. Captain David Pelton of the Allendale Fire Department said the fire was the first he knew of that was started by an April Fool's prank. The extent of the damage to the building was unknown, but residents were allowed to return to two of the building's six units. Firefighters said other residents were expected to be able to return later, but the apartment where the fire started was unlikely to be considered safe. Firefighters said the girl whose prank ignited the flames probably won't face charges from the incident. Okay, how do you not get charged for playing with firecrackers indoors and nearly burning down a building? I can just see the lawsuits, by the way, whizzing in at high speed from all those other tenants. I can just see that. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Ion Productions of Cincinnati is eager to sell the world's first commercially available handheld flamethrower, the XM42, which would shoot 25-foot flames and cost between $700 and $800. Ion announced in March that it was seeking additional funding, touting the device's uses, like killing insects, eliminating weeds between pavement cracks, melting snow, entertaining friends, and assuring potential buyers that portable flamethrowers are less regulated than handguns. Oh, that's nice to know. Only California and Maryland legislators and a few city or county officials appear to be on top of the issue of amateur flame throwing. Okay, the only possible reason that I can think of to condone selling these things is, albeit an extremely selfish one on my part, because the clowns who buy it will continue to supply me with an endless amount of material for the Stuff File News, not to mention potential candidates for the Darwin File. So let's all wait and see what happens, okay? Anyway, let's move on to our first guest on the program, shall we? Actor Charlie Kunz has literally graduated from the role he played on NBC's Community to the new CBS hit series CSI Cyber, where he plays FBI agent and tech whiz Daniel Grumitz. Charlie joins us once again on the line right now from California. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, sir. Thank you for having me back on.
Thanks for being back on the program. So how does it feel to be part of what's clearly a big hit?
It feels awesome. After a few years of cutting my teeth on Community, it feels amazing to be able to go to work every day and be able to be part of CBS, which is huge, and CSI, which is huge, and just get to work with all these awesome actors, which, of course, is my favorite part. So, yeah, it's kind of mind-blowing in a lot of different ways.
What did you do in preparing for the role of Daniel?
Well, we rely heavily on our writers, and we also have a lot of technical consultants from the FBI and a lot of private sector cybersecurity areas, I guess is the best way to put it. So we've actually had a lot of people. My character, who's been part of the FBI for about 10 years, I thought it would be, you know, most important to talk to actual FBI agents and consultants and things like that. And we learned a lot. You know, obviously, we have a little bit of ER syndrome where, you know, you can't have a full grasp of every single term that comes across your desk, but they've been a huge, huge help. And, you know, and also just to get into the mindset of somebody who works for the FBI, that's a pretty serious position with a pretty serious moral compass. So that's how I've been doing it. Hopefully it's working.
As an actor, is it different for you? Because in the past you've done guest starring roles, you've showed up on existing programs, but here you're getting a chance to literally create a character from the ground up. How much of the, for instance, Daniel's backstory is written for you, and how much do you have to kind of figure it out of you on your own to play off of?
I think, you know, when we started the show, we had the one episode written, you know, just our first episode. So that's always laying the groundwork for what the character is in that moment. And then in terms of growing, you just really get to know the group. You get to know the actors, and they get to know each other, and you get to know the writers and who vibes well with who and all that kind of thing. And, you know, for me personally, because it's such a procedural and there are so many rules to follow in terms of, you know, solving the crime and all of the avenues you need to go through, I was really shocked at how quickly and amazingly I got along with Shad Moss, Bawa, who plays Brody Nelson. And that, right from the very first day that we met, we started making each other laugh and having a great time, and that kind of stuff started to make it into the scripts, and the writers get to see that and who vibes well with who and who just cracks each other up. So there's definitely a lot of good Crummets and Nelson stories coming up. And then, you know, and then we get to break off as the series goes. And I got to do last week, I got to do a scene with, or episode four rather, with Peter McNichol. And, you know, as the series goes on, they break us off into pairs, and you really get to know the actor you're working with, and people just get to see variations. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, there are rules that we need to follow, but at the same time, everyone's paying attention to relationships that build and are fun to write and fun to have, and I just feel very lucky that Bow Wow is my partner in crime. I wouldn't have it any other way.
We also got a chance to see a little bit more of your character, and I guess you got to learn a little bit more of your backstory with a situation that involved a sister and your parents. I don't want to give it away for anybody who might not have seen it, although it was a couple of weeks
ago.
But I mean, what was that like to get into that mindset and learn a little bit about the background of your character?
It was amazing. And, you know, you mentioned coming from a guest star. The one thing that I really learned from doing Community, which is, you know, a vastly different beast being a half-hour comedy, when I come in, you know, I'm not a regular on the show, so I'm the setup man in a lot of situations. Like, I toss the ball and they get to hit it, you know, set up, punchline kind of thing. But this has been awesome to actually get to sit with one person and find out their history, because we find it out, you know, the second it gets finished being written, they send it to us and you go, oh my God, I can't believe you wrote that. I can't believe that's where I'm coming from. And that takes you sort of further. So I would love to mention that the young lady that plays my sister, Angela Trimber, is fantastic. And she'll be coming back, which is great. And that goes along the same thing. I've actually known her for quite a while. She's done a few things in Community, actually. But we got together, and we've been friends for 2 or 3 years. And that relationship just feels lived in. So then, you know, you drop a little pebble of a story with Crummets, which I was so amazingly overjoyed to get to play. And, you know, hopefully it went well, and it went well enough to sort of extend that story into future episodes. So I don't want to spoil the one that people haven't seen, but also don't want to spoil the ones that are coming down the line. But yeah, Crummets has quite a lot to deal with coming up.
Excellent. Well, I know we talked in the past when we were on the program last time. We talked about your school background. You have a bachelor's degree in theater arts from Loyola Marymount University, and I bring that up only mm-hmm. because when you work in theater, it teaches you, you know, the rudimentary parts of acting. But now you're on this hit show. You've got to deal with things that you don't normally have to deal with as an actor. For instance, like talking to the media or live tweeting. What's that like?
What, the line preparation?
Live tweeting, for instance.
Live tweeting.
Yeah.
Live tweeting is more stressful than the learning the lines. live tweeting, I'm really trying to figure out the best way to do it. James told me that it's best to do it during commercials, but I just get super excited and I try to respond to everybody. And, you know, on the first pass, I miss half of the show, so I have to watch it immediately afterwards to just see what happened. I'm like looking down at my computer and picking out little random spots and trying to answer questions. And Val is sending me videos all the time saying, like, yo, Charlie, where's Cromit? Why are you doing that to your boy? I'm just like, I'm tweeting a thousand different people. I can't talk to you right now. That's been a really fun but really strange experience to be home and watching it with everybody at the same time.
Does that response, that instant feedback literally from the fans, does that in any way, shape, or form affect how you down the road play the character? Does fan response play in your mind when it's so immediate with things like Twitter?
Sure. I think it does. I think, you know, we make it for them. So it would be foolish not to listen to them. There are things that go into making a show that you can't always address, or you can't always fix in the way that somebody might like them to or like us to. But I think if you start to get an overwhelming sense of people saying the same thing over and over and over again, I think it has to have an effect. And that can either be, you know, we've gotten a really great response from Crummett and Nelson. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that feels that just lets you know that you're sort of on the right track with the relationship that people like. And also, if people have something to say about your performance, you know, we have, I'm just doing my best here. So I welcome all of the constructive criticism as I can handle. So, you know, it's having 10 million eyes on something you did at work one day. And, you know, you take your lumps if it didn't work, and you take your suggestions if they make sense to you. And I think it's really invaluable. And, you know, like I said, we try to make it for them. So we want it to be as good as it can be for them, and we just want the fans to really enjoy it. So
One last quick question. You said you were on your computer. You know, a little bit of information can be a dangerous thing. In playing the role that you play, are you afraid to even turn on your computer or answer your phone nowadays?
It's definitely become an increase in my awareness of what exactly all of these things do. And that's what we try to do on the show is, you know, we're not trying to scare anybody into not using their devices. That's not the intention. We have nothing to gain from that. That's certainly not the intention. But when we write a show, we sort of start with the capabilities of a device, like a phone or an iPad or a computer, and really just simply, and we have our consultants, which is really great, like, this is what these things are capable of. And then we have really amazing creative writers and, you know, producers who have done CSI for the last 16 years across multiple franchises of it. And we try to build a really entertaining story from it. So, you know, we had an episode about an Uber type company called Zogo that we made up, about somebody sort of getting into that system and manipulating the information that was in there. Does that happen every single time somebody gets a car? No. You know, I use services like that all the time. Is it important to make sure you're getting into the right car and you know who you're with and you know where, you know, somebody knows where you are and all that kind of stuff? Yeah, I think that's becoming more and more important just because of all the capabilities of these things. So, you know, I compare it to, yeah, the possibility of getting hit by a bus when you walk out of your front door, but you can't stay inside all the time. So more awareness, and it certainly has helped me out quite a bit.
16 years, the original CSI. Do you hope that this one, CSI Cyber, does the same?
I think everybody's hoping that. but, you know, I have been a fan of television for as long as I can remember. So as far as I know, the only way to get that far is to keep making good shows, and that's definitely what we're trying to do. It none works if, you know, they don't hold up the standard. So we'll see. We'll keep our fingers crossed, and we'll certainly keep doing our best and trying to make more.
Well, congratulations on the show, Charlie, and I hope it has a long run, although you've made me terribly afraid to use my printer. Continued success with all that you do, and thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's such a great time, as always, chatting with you.
Actor Charlie Kuntz from the hit series CSI Cyber. You can see CSI Cyber Wednesdays at 10 on both CBS and CTV. And as the saying goes, check your local listings.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the co-author of In the Company of Legends. Plus, we'll meet a former RCMP officer who's written a thriller. We, of course, have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And right now, much more Stuff File news on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, thanks to Bob Welsh at WDEV in Vermont for keeping us up to date on this latest edition of a heinous crime spree afoot. The snack-provoked crime wave continues in America. One week after a father allegedly shot his son in the butt over an empty orange juice container, a woman in Akron, Ohio allegedly stabbed her boyfriend in the stomach because he ate all of their salsa. 50-year-old Phyllis Jefferson let her boyfriend know that he was eating too much of their salsa. He apparently continued to eat the salsa because Jefferson ended up allegedly stabbing him with a pen in his hip for not sharing. Things only got worse for the 61-year-old boyfriend. Evidently still angry, Jefferson knocked over the couple's TV, and when her boyfriend stood up to catch it, she allegedly grabbed a kitchen knife and stabbed him in the stomach. The boyfriend was found by police outside their apartment clutching his stomach, his hands and shirt covered in blood, and was treated at a local hospital. Jefferson fled the couple's home but was arrested on a nearby interstate. She was charged with felonious assault and one misdemeanor count of criminal damaging. Well, let's hope that while in jail she doesn't get any salsa because, you know, for some folks, salsa is just too hot to handle. And a Kmart loss prevention officer in Kingsport, Virginia, was suspicious after seeing a woman with wire cutters in the jewelry section. The officer said he saw 34-year-old Quashonda Wolf. And seriously, who names their kid Quashonda anyway? Anyway, the officer saw Quashonda use the wire cutters to cut a security cable attached to a countertop display case, then load the 3-foot-tall case, complete with 37 pairs of earrings valued at $249.99 per pair, into her shopping cart and just walk out the front door. A Kmart personnel stopped her outside, escorted her into the office, and called the police. Wolf was charged with theft of property over $1,000 and vandalism. At the jail, Wolf gave her motive, saying she wanted to sell the stolen jewelry to buy stuff for her child. Wow. Well, you can't buy love, but some people think that you can steal it, huh? Right. Meanwhile, moving on to Thailand, Thailand's culture minister has warned women in the country that under-boob selfies are illegal per the 2007 Computer Crimes Act. Women who post photos of the lower part of their breasts could go to prison for up to 5 years. And how will they be able to prosecute women? When people take these under-boob selfies, no one can see their faces, admits a ministry spokesperson. So it's like we don't know who these belong to, and it encourages others to do the same. We can only warn people to not take it up. They are inappropriate actions. Inappropriate or not, the trend has gone viral online. Gee, I must be out of the social media loop because I wasn't aware that under-boob selfies was a thing. Then again, I already think that most selfies are of boobs anyway. Yeah. Kevin Wallen is a good person, said Jean Enriquez, the former mayor of Danbury, Connecticut. Wallen, who is 63, was on a university board. He was active in inner city charity. He helped create an AIDS ministry and was once secretary to a bishop. And as a Roman Catholic priest, he gave eloquent sermons. Oh, and he owned an adult store. Though his prosecutors are probably emphasizing that more than the authors of the 80-plus letters urging a judge to show mercy in his case, federal agents say the Land of Oz and Dorothy's place appeared to be a part of the good father's plans to launder money he made in the meth business. Wallen faces up to 11 years in prison after pleading guilty to conspiracy. Well, prayer, drugs, and adult goods. He was a one-man mall for the miserable, wasn't he? And as religion teaches, he was something to everyone. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 25-year-old Brian Laura of New City, New York, was arrested on drug charges after an undercover operation and housed in the Rockland County Jail. Now, weeks later, it seems jailers had reason to search him and his cell. Sure enough, they found 50 pills, and Laura admitted he had been selling pills to other inmates. Laura was charged with felony possession of a controlled substance with intent to sell, misdemeanor possession of a controlled substance, and misdemeanor promoting prison contraband. The question then became, how did he smuggle the drugs in? Well, in his rectum. And it was from there that he also sold them. I did mention that he had been in jail for several weeks, right? Yeah. Drug use. It's just so glamorous, isn't it? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? David Healy is one half of the producing team that put together film portraits on the lives and careers of many Hollywood legends. And now he and his partner, Joan Kramer, have told their story of dealing with Hollywood's elite in their book, In the Company of Legends. David joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, David.
Hey, Peter. It's great to be on the Stuff File.
Great to have you on the program with us. Now, I got to admit right off the bat, very jealous of the life you and Joan have led, having the opportunity to talk to the people who so many people idolize from the film world.
Well, you know, Peter, it's amazing that when you're doing it, because it was our job, we didn't quite realize what was going on. It's when we came to write the book, I think we were both astonished. Yes, it's quite astounding the number of famous people we've been in contact with and got to know.
What exactly was the point when you said, you know, because, I mean, you've done these documentaries, which we'll talk about in a little bit. You've done these documentaries. At what point did you say, there's a book here?
Well, over the years, we've talked to our friends and we've told them stories. Sometimes people say, you press a button and I'll tell you a story. And they always said, oh, you must write a book about this. Of course, we ignored it. And then after we retired, we said, maybe we should write a book. We started writing down the stories. Of course, it was a new discipline for us, writing a book. We'd written scripts for television, but it's very different writing the stories in book form. So that's how it came about.
One of the things I gather from the interactions you have with some of the Hollywood celebrities, first of all, people realize that Hollywood celebrities are just people. But I think the important thing, and I don't know if you meant to show this, but it reflects well on the two of you, and that is you treat them with respect and you get respect.
Well, first of all, yes, they are consummate professionals. And one of the things that we did discover was that the stars that were raised in the studio system from the 30s and 40s and 50s have a tremendous discipline. You tell them when you want them to turn up, and they're there. In the case of Katharine Hepburn, she was always there early and wondering why we weren't ready. So, yes, of course, they deserve respect, but of course, they're real people, too. And as time went on, we got to know some of them and discovered what was behind the facade of the famous person.
Well, you talk about the old Hollywood studio system, and that was one of the questions I wanted to ask, and that is, do you think something is lost with the demise of the studio system? I mean, I know there were disadvantages to it. Some people thought it was kind of like servitude, but was there something lost when that went away?
Well, yes, there was something lost, but it's not so much the demise of the studio system as the advent of television, the internet, and accessibility. In the days of the studio system, the studios protected their stars, and they had a huge publicity apparatus out there to tell us who those stars were. And to see them, we had to go to a theater, and we saw them on a huge screen. There was something slightly remote about the movie stars of that period, and they were therefore on a pedestal for us. Today, they're very accessible. Their every move is documented for us. So even though the stars of today are certainly extremely talented, there's some wonderful people out there, they don't feel as quite remote as they did in that time. And I think that makes a difference to how we look at them.
How did you and Joan get together in the first place to start doing documentaries about some of the Hollywood stars? I was very intrigued, for instance, by the story of just trying to get Fred Astaire on board.
Yes. Well, as so many things like this, it started by accident. We'd been thrown together on a local public television series in New York called Skyline. And Joan had booked Rudolf Nureyev, and we did a show with him. He was in town to dance with the Joffrey Ballet. And Joan said to me, you know, I booked Nureyev when I worked on the Dick Cavett show. She previously had been a booker for the ABC Late Night Show. And she said, he is such an admirer of Fred Astaire. He thinks Astaire is the greatest American dancer of all time. From that discussion, it's a longer story, but we decided to try and do a show about Astaire, a documentary about Astaire. But when we approached him, actually our executive producer approached him first, he basically said, go away, I don't want anything like this, please leave me alone. We wrote to him, we heard from his agent, Mr. Astaire is furious, he doesn't want you to do anything. What we discovered was he really didn't like the sort of tribute shows that were very common on TV in those days, where somebody would sit in the audience and their friends and colleagues would get on stage and shower them with compliments, and Astaire was not that sort of person. He didn't like that, to be put in that position. So we persevered. And in the end, we heard again from his agent saying, okay, because of your tenacity, Mr. Astaire's agreed to give you permission to do the show. Now, what we didn't realize was that was important. We thought he was a public figure. We could do the show anyway. But it turned out that he had control of the clips of his early films. In the 30s, his lawyer was very clever and had written into his contract that he could control the use of clips. Fortunately, we didn't know that, so in our ignorance, we were pressing on. But to get his permission was actually a huge advance, and then he cooperated and let us use the clip from one of his shows that he owned. So we moved on from there.
And that brings me back to the point of treating people with respect, because there's a very fine line when you mention about how he gave in because of your tenacity from being someone who has that kind of tenacity and going over the edge and being someone who is pushy or a bully or doesn't care about what somebody thinks. There's that fine line, isn't there?
It's a very fine line. It's a very fine line. You have to pressure without alienating. For example, again in the same show, we knew what, Fred said he wouldn't appear. He gave us permission to do a show, but he didn't want to be interviewed. So we thought, well, at least we can do the show. But we knew if we didn't have Fred that we had to have Ginger. And Ginger Rogers was fed up of talking about Fred. She felt that after she made Kitty Foyle and received an Oscar for that, she was an actress in her own right. And yet everybody who interviewed her always wanted to talk about Fred. So there was a huge barrier to overcome there to persuade her to take part. And it was a case of gently pressuring her until we convinced her that we wanted to hear her side of the story. We didn't want her to talk about Fred. We said, tell us what it was like for you to do those dances, what it was like to wear those wonderful gowns, what it was like to dance on those shiny floors, what it was like in rehearsal. And she eventually said yes. And that, if you look at the show, she's actually talking about herself much more than she's talking about Fred. But the feeling of the whole show is that it's the two of them.
When you finally had the opportunity to finish this product, put it all together, air it on and air it, did it make a difference in acquiring the permission from other people when they saw the love and care you put into putting the Fred Astaire show together?
Well, one of the great things that happened was we won an Emmy for one of the Astaire project ended up being two shows, and the second of the two shows won an Emmy. So that gave us a kind of badge of approval. So on top of having done a show with one of the most respected of all Hollywood stars, Fred Astaire, and being successful and getting tremendous reviews, the Emmy got us to the next step, so that when we were approaching other people, they knew we weren't going to do a hatchet job. They knew we were going to do a quality product, and they basically respected our ability to do a show like that.
Now, you did what, about 17 of these things?
Oh my God, I haven't counted.
Yeah.
It's quite a lot.
And just looking at the list of the ones, I was going to ask you which ones were your favorite ones to do, but I'm going on a limb, and I'm assuming that, you know, you had the opportunity to do some of them while people who you feature are still alive, as opposed to others who had since passed on. Was that always the added kick in having the opportunity to be in contact with the actual subject?
It certainly was, but I have to say that asking us to choose our favorite show is a bit like asking Astaire to choose his favorite partner. it's a difficult one, but if I'm pushed against the wall, it would probably have to be the last show we did with Katharine Hepburn, which was called Katharine Hepburn All About Me. It was also unique in that she was the only person on the show. It did not interview other people and ask them to talk about her. It was her telling her story, and so it was unique show in its format. It was also the culmination of the many times we worked with Katharine Hepburn, and so there's something very special about that one.
Now, I understand also that on April 7th, Turner Classic Movies will be screening 5 of your documentaries that you've done, right?
Yes. Yes, that's wonderful. I mean, we were very thankful to them. We feel very close to TCM.
Was it difficult, since, like you say, it's picking your favorite dances, picking your favorite child? Is it difficult to pick the 5 that they're doing?
Well, we didn't pick them. TCM picked the shows, and they did some. They made pretty good choices, I think. We're very, very happy with those shows and very proud of them.
The title of the book is In the Company of Legends, and I have to say that in talking to you, David, I feel like I'm in the company of legends, and I'm not talking about the Hollywood stars, I'm talking about yourself.
Please, don't make me blush.
I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us, sir.
Peter, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
David Healy, co-author of In the Company of Legends. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0294, and you'll find links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. And you can also catch screenings of 5 of the documentaries that David Healy and Joan Kramer did on April 7th on Turner Classic Movies. Check your local listings. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Do you ever use a cell phone at home? Or how about Wi-Fi for your computer? If so, listen to this. A New Mexico woman was sued by her neighbor who claimed that her use of an ordinary cell phone and Wi-Fi in her own home was damaging his health. And, now get this, he demanded $1.4 million. After 2 years of expensive legal action over common technology that's been used by millions of Americans for years, the judge finally threw out the lawsuit. But the man appealed, and recently, 5 years after the lawsuit was filed, a court of appeals has upheld the dismissal. However, both courts ruled that the woman who won still had to pay more than $80,000 in legal costs. Let's be fair. Lawsuits like this reveal that even when you win in American courts, you often lose because of the time and money you're forced to spend. It's not like this in any other country in the world, and it shouldn't be here. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Thin Black Line. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. I have mentioned Stitcher before, have I not? I think I have. You know, you can hear this show and many other shows, like over 20,000 different shows and counting, because every time you talk about Stitcher, the numbers of radio shows you can hear seems to go up and up and up. Anyway, you can hear all these shows on demand. Download the free app today. Listen anywhere, anytime on your mobile device. Stitcher is an award-winning free app that lets you listen to all of your favorite shows. Hopefully The Stuff File is one of them. You can create your own custom playlists, and you can also rate and review shows on Stitcher. So if you like The Stuff File, for instance, please go there and rate this program as well. I'd appreciate it. It's in over 4 million car dashboards and counting. It, again, just goes up and up and up. Many places and the many ways you can listen to Stitcher Smart Radio. Have I mentioned before it's a smarter way to listen to radio? Yes, indeed. It's the smarter way to listen to radio. So get the app for Stitcher right now. Okay, back to the Stuff File news. And I said, one more item to go before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. And of course, an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. The NYPD seized Cam Brock's car because they suspected she was on marijuana, though they couldn't find any when they searched her car. That's what her lawyers say. Then, when she went to get the car back, she was locked up for psychiatric treatment. The Harlem Hospital diagnosed her with inability to test reality and unemployment. Well, since when is unemployment a psychiatric situation? Yeah. Anyway, their goals for her? The patient will verbalize the importance of education for employment and will state that Obama is not following her on Twitter. Well, in fact, Brooke works for Astoria Bank, so she's not unemployed, and at Barack Obama, the president's verified Twitter account, does follow her on Twitter. But that didn't save her from 8 days locked in the psych ward, nor from forced injections of drugs, nor from waking up to being stripped of her underwear, according to her and her lawsuit. Oh, methinks she's going to win. Wow. If inability to recognize reality warrants detention, humiliation, and forcible injection, shouldn't those things be done to the doctors who did them to her? Just a thought. Anyway, let's get to our final guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Simon Gervais is a former RCMP officer who has worked as an air marshal, counterintelligence expert, and as a bodyguard for visiting heads of state such as Queen Elizabeth and Barack Obama. His background has enabled him to write his first book, The Thin Black Line, a political thriller set in Ottawa and Europe. And Simon joins us on the line right now from Ottawa. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I'm just wondering, during your years of working in all those jobs that I just mentioned, did you think to yourself, whoa, some of these things would make a good book? Or was that something that came after you retired?
It came after. No, actually, it came before I retired. The thing is, I've always been an avid reader. I started when I was very young reading Robert Ludlum's novel. So when I worked counterterrorism from 2004 to 2008, I was traveling a lot. So I had a lot of time to read books. And me and my colleagues suddenly realized that these books, okay, they have a good plot, but they aren't realistic. It's not how it is in the field. So I came with an idea,
And I said, maybe I should write something that's going to appeal to law enforcement officer and military personnel that actually serve in the field, and they will be able to relate to my book much better than if I write interesting plot, but nothing inside will be realistic. So that's how I started.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. But having said that, I mean, as you know, be it medical dramas, dramas that deal with law enforcement, which is your business, dramas that deal with media, which is my business. Sometimes if you do the nuts and bolts reality of what it is to do that job, you kind of water down what it might be, what might be interesting to the general population. Were you worried about that when you started writing this book?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I understand your question very well. You know that 90% of police work is paperwork, really, especially when you're into investigation. So, of course, I didn't write a book about note-taking and paperwork and warrants writing. No, no. It's an action-packed spy thriller, very similar, actually, to Robert Ludlum's The Bourne Identity. So if you enjoy The Bourne Identity's movie with Matt Damon, you'll love The Thin Black Line. It's really action-packed. It's just that the firefight scene, the action scenes, for example, you won't find anyone shooting down an helicopter with a pistol while driving a motorcycle backward. You won't get that in my book. What you'll get is the real stuff. It's how I really wrote the book in a way that the readers will feel like they're the one in the field.
Okay, so tell us about the plot of The Thin Black Line.
Okay, so as I said, it's a action-packed spy thriller that follows Mike Walton, who is a former RCMP officer specialized in counterterrorism, and his wife, Lisa Walton, who is a physician. So there's an attack in Ottawa, and they suffer a huge loss, both physically and emotionally. And what happened after that is that they get recruited by the International Market Stabilization Institute, which is a covert organization in the U.S., but it's completely financed by three corporate muggle that lives in New York. So what it does is that they do the same thing as a covert organization would do, but without all the red tape. So Mike and Lisa are sent to Europe and Africa to go after the Sheikh Al-Assad, because Sheikh Al-Assad is the terrorist mastermind that plotted the attack in Ottawa and Montreal. So they go after him to take revenge on their family and stop the threat that Sheikh Al-Assad is representing, because what he's trying to do is bring the Western economy to its knees by attacking the tourism and the oil industry. So the book starts in Ottawa, but then you go to Africa, you go to Europe, then you go back to Canada. So all the locations that I've read about in the book are locations that I've been to in real life.
Now, your main character is Mike Walton, who is, as you say, a former RCMP officer. You're
correct.
A former RCMP officer. How much of Simon Gervais is in Mike Walton?
Well, quite a lot. But you have to understand, it's still a fiction book, right? But his wife is a physician. Well, my wife is an endodontist, so it's different. He was in the military before. He was part of the Canadian Special Operation Regiment. I wasn't. I was just a regular infantry officer. I have no special forces training, but, you know, he has a little bit of the same background, because I wanted to write about something I was passionate about and something that I knew a lot about at the same time.
How long was the writing process for you to put this book together?
It took me about 5 years, but you have to keep in mind that at some point, I was working 40 to 60 hours with the RCMP, so sometimes I had only a few hours a month to write. But what I did, I took a year off without pay in 2012 to concentrate on my writing, and this is where I did 90% of the writing done, was while I was on that leave without pay. So it really took me about 18 months of full-time work to write the book. But then again, you're not automatically published after that. You still need to find an agent, and the agent needs to find a publisher, and then there's still a waiting period between when the publisher buys the book and it,
it goes on the shelf as chapters.
The reason why I asked the question of how long it took you to write the book, it must have been kind of chilling to write this book over a long period of time. And just when you're near the finish line, just when you're getting ready to publish, you suddenly hear stories of actual terrorist attacks taking place in Ottawa and Quebec.
Absolutely. I just retired for a few weeks when that happened, actually. But yes, I mean, I think most of us thriller writers, we try to follow current events to write something that people will be able to relate to. And unfortunately, this one, it may be a little bit too close to home.
Hmm. Taking the time off, as you say, to write the book, I mean, this wasn't just something that was clearly a hobby. I mean, you literally put your money where your mouth is, taking time off from work. This was a real passion project for you. Was this a book that you had to get out of your system, that you had to write?
Oh, I think so. Because as I said earlier, I really feel passionate about writing a book that was as realistic as it can be related to what we actually do in the field. And I think once you start something, you either do it or you don't. And at some point, I said to myself, I really need to do this right, because the publishing standards are so high now. The book needs to be perfect. So I had no other choice but to take a full year off to concentrate on it.
You mentioned some of the books that you loved reading before you started writing your book, and a lot of those authors have serialized stories, continuations mm-hmm. with their protagonist. Are you considering the idea, now that you've written this one book, that more will follow?
Oh, absolutely. I signed a two-book deal with my publisher, and I'm presently writing book number two with Mike Walton again, and hopefully the book will do well, and I'll be offered another contract. And my idea is to really serialize this series. Absolutely. Now, really, I'm thinking about writing maybe at least 4 to 5 books with the same characters.
People always say you got to write what you know. So people who know Simon Gervais, would they recognize either you or maybe themselves in other characters in the book?
I think all law enforcement officer will relate to Mike Walton, because he's struggling against an organization that is very good, very professional, but there's so much red tape that he can't get anything done. So I think everybody's going to relate to this, absolutely, especially if you're law enforcement, military, or spouses of law enforcement officer, or simply just a fan of TV shows like NCIS or Hawaii 50, something like that. I think that you're really going to enjoy this book.
Well, speaking of which, you mentioned television. You mentioned movies like The Bourne Identity. Do you foresee your book, your character, making its way to either the big or small screen?
Yes, absolutely. My agent, actually, Eric Myers, from the Denzel Goddard Agency in New York, received a call from Tobey Maguire's agent, who is, you know, the protagonist in Spider-Man, the main actor there. He has a movie company as well. And they're interested in reading the book and maybe, you know, I don't know, option it for a movie. And I think there was another company called Shine America. They do the Tudors on TV and MasterChef series that also want to see the book for TV potential.
Wow. So things are looking up for not only Mike Walton, but for Simon Gervais. Congratulations.
No, absolutely. It's great. And so far, the book has done very, very well, both at Chapters and Amazon Canada. I think that at some point, it was number one spy thriller in Canada for a few days, and it reached as high as number 68 on the best-selling list.
Congratulations. The book is called The Thin Black Line, written by Simon Gervais. Simon, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program, and congratulations.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter. Really, really enjoyed our chat.
Simon Gervais, author of The Thin Black Line. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0294, and you'll find links to Simon's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
it seems to be that there is an increasing amount of criminals on the run who unintentionally reveal their whereabouts by the need to show off on social media. But Christopher Wallace has reached legendary show-off status. Being sought in connection with a January burglary, he went to his home in Fairfield, Maine, and posted on the Snapchat site that that's where he was. Oh, but it gets better. Police arrived and during their canvas noticed a brand new Snapchat post by Wallace, mischievously writing that police were in his home right then, searching for him, but that he was cunningly hiding in a cabinet. Police opened the cabinet and arrested him. Okay, this is one that I just can't stop laughing about. I hope that when he's in the courtroom for his trial or sentencing, that everybody else has a difficult time controlling their laughter, because Christopher really needs to have it sink into his thick skull that he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0294. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0294. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCore in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.